So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F-35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview. When Madison Police Chief Mike Koval retired, I saw an opportunity. Maybe I could get Chief Koval and former Dane County Sheriff Rick Ramish to come in to talk about some of these serious law enforcement and criminal justice issues. Mr. Ramish, after he became sheriff, was the administrator of the prison systems in both Wisconsin and Colorado. And I got lucky. Both of these gentlemen agreed to come in. Chief Mike Koval, thanks very much. Retired Chief Koval.
Yes, as you can see by my wardrobe, I embraced the moment.
You look great in it. And former sheriff and Colorado and Wisconsin prison system administrator, Mr. Ramish, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are we ever really formerary? Are we always in recovery?
What a great comment. I want to talk about some big picture issues that both the states and the nation are dealing with. Let's start with marijuana legalization. Let's start narrowly. Medical marijuana, should it be legalized? I don't care who goes for first. You.
I'd like to have you defer. You're this elder statesman, and you have that Colorado experience under your belt, Sheriff.
You know, I'm not a proponent of legalization, but I'm a realist. And the reality is that it's here now. And when states like Colorado have legalized it, it's time for the rest of the states to follow suit. Otherwise, you just get all these problems. So not just medical, but recreational also. It should be legalized. Now, it should be regulated correctly, but it should be legalized.
But you prefaced it by saying you're not an advocate of it.
I am not. I saw in Colorado.
But you're a realist.
I'm a realist. I mean, it's here. It's a door that's been opened that I don't think is going to be closed. I think that the social costs are going to far outweigh any monetary benefits that states will see from it, but it's here, and we might as well accept that, acknowledge it, and use the money that is gained from taxes, for instance, and use that in the appropriate way.
Well, quick follow-up. Did you see the quality of life generally in Colorado change as Colorado legalized first medical and then recreational?
I don't think you saw a change. I mean, to show my naivety, I thought these operations would be run by people wearing flower dresses and aging hippies, and of course, it's very professional and very well done. But what I did see is that the border states that had not legalized, seeing citizens from all over coming in just to buy and then to take it back to their states, it creates a terrible law enforcement problem for the border states.
Chief, thanks for your patience. Medical first and then recreational?
Yeah, I think I have to share some of the pragmatism that's been expressed by Sheriff Ramish in the sense that Madison, Wisconsin, we're literally now becoming landlocked with all of our neighboring states. It's just a question of when their matriculation dates begin. Mm-hmm. I too, though, want to hit sort of the tap the brakes moment in the sense that I'd like to see us go a little more incrementally and have that opportunity to sort of watch, look, learn, and observe the unintended consequences of these rollouts that we're seeing in the contiguous states. I think for me, having seen my own dad with cancer and other people who I have an employee whose son, I think, had severe cerebral palsy issues, to be able to see the medical therapeutic value of what is arguably to be obtained by marijuana is very encouraging. I'd like us to see us sort of fast-track FDA clinical trials and work through sort of the certified sanctioned elements of seeing medical come first. Obviously, we're both in agreement that at a minimum, I'd like to see the possessory marijuana crimes decriminalized altogether and made forfeitures as we do with alcohol.
How many grams?
Well, you know, sort of those casual possessory amounts of less than a gram, probably. And the fact of the matter is that I, too, understand that the proverbial handwriting is on the wall. But I would like us to say that just because the first lemming jumps off the cliff, does it have to be inevitable for all of us? I think that we're still seeing some of the byproducts or unintended consequences of the Colorado experience. Yes. In terms of a lot of things that they thought they had thought out strategically didn't begin to meet those sort of expectations. And so I'd like us to move very slowly, methodically, and yes, starting first with the medical applications, and then over time decriminalizing and perhaps looking at it as a regulatory substance as we have with alcohol or cigarettes.
Are you both glad that you're not the police chiefs in Beloit and Racine now that Illinois is soon going to be legalizing recreational marijuana? Kind of goes back to what you said, Rick.
Yeah, it's going to create a lot of law enforcement problems for the those agencies that not only are on the border, but the whole state, because as the chief said, we're basically surrounded now, or will be soon, and it creates a lot of law enforcement
problems. What about if I'm a patrol officer? Do I have any effective way to know someone if someone is impaired by marijuana as opposed to alcohol with the breathalyzers and other tests? How does that work in Colorado?
Well, that's when I said that the tax money that's gained from that, from the sale, should be used appropriately, and part of that is to is used to train law enforcement on techniques to be able to identify those that are under the influence of controlled substances.
Do they behave a lot differently than someone who's impaired by alcohol, Rick?
I think that's a big, it depends, to use
right.
our scholarly legal
Thanks.
Advice.
Thank you.
I think right now what we're seeing, and I agree with the sheriff, is that when you create a void, there's a niche that has to be filled, and I think you'll find forensic science and entrepreneurs will create testing mechanisms that will keep pace with that. They're not in real time where they ought to be or where we'd like to be, but those are moving forward and pressing forward. And we've seen some encouraging laboratory results in some of these small micro units of laboratory analysis. But moreover, we're finding that when we pull over people for impaired driving, more often than not, about a third of them are not just with alcohol or
Correct.
Fermented malt beverages. They already have some measure of
drugs.
These other drugs on them. So there are mechanisms. About a third.
One third.
Yeah, about a third. And so there are already mechanisms field practitioners can use in terms of horizontal gaze nystagmus tests, or HGN, and other impairment indicia. Plus, you know, so many of our first-time and subsequent drunk drivers are going to be tested for by blood. So you get a search warrant. So if you don't have the indicia of the alcohol that we're looking for, the lack of odor or other things, we can have those blood analyses submitted to a greater matrix of testing as well.
On a related issue, about 2.5 weeks ago, maybe three, Milwaukee area Democrats said that if you're have a conviction for nonviolent marijuana possession, that should be vacated. That should be erased. Mr. Former Corrections Secretary, would that be a wise policy change?
Yes. I think it's not only wise, I just think it's the correct thing to do under the circumstances. And I sat on the pardon board in Colorado, and those types of convictions came up often, and we routinely recommended that they be erased.
A position on that, sir?
I totally agree. As a matter of fact, if it were up to me, I'd like to see a complete revisitation of CCAP in general in terms of its pervasiveness, in terms of encouraging pervasive racism. I think it's a mechanism in which people can be discriminated on for a lifetime when it comes to looking for housing, scholarships, jobs, and a whole host of things like that by unscrupulous or unethical people who have that in their hands and have the power to make those critical decisions. But I was encouraged just most recently to see our own governor, for example, gave a gubernatorial pardon to an individual who had a possessory drug conviction. And now with that expunged, this individual can look at pursuing a career in firefighting, which he would have otherwise been prohibited from. So we had our class read the book, our recruit class read the book, Just Mercies by Brian Stevens.
I read that. That's a powerful book.
Powerful book. And when you consider how many people are currently in federal prisons and state institutions with convictions for drug possession in general, wow, what an incredible watershed moment we could have if we could revisit some of those issues above and beyond the marijuana issue.
But we see we journalists use CCAPs.
Oh, yes.
So we're not unscrupulous, are we, Chief?
No, because I think you look at it as a mechanism for fact-finding, investigative history,
yes,
back pages, and I totally understand that.
But debate in the Capitol is also centered on landlords using it to deny rental.
Employers.
And employers. Thank you very much. Okay.
So therein lies the rub. And I think we have to have a more deeper-rooted conversation about that as a matter of public policy. You know, if you have a traffic ticket or a lot of things over a certain period of times, the Department of Motor Vehicle will expunge those records so you're not constantly being beaten up when you go pay for your insurance and things.
Yep.
And perhaps we could have a similar equivalency looking at some of the things that are currently being held on to CCAP forever.
Rick, I just looked at the Wisconsin DOC site, and we have 23,600 or so adult inmates. How many inmates did you supervise in the state of Colorado? Do you remember?
It was about 22,000.
About 22,000. Mm-hmm. In Wisconsin, January 1 stats, 42% of our adult inmates were African Americans. Thoughts on how we could no longer be the state that incarcerates the most number of African Americans, Rick?
Yeah, you know, one has to look at prisons are back doors, obviously. I mean, it's the end of the system. And which means to get there, you have to go through many different doors to end up in prison. And so a big part of that is front-end diversion. You know, once they get to prison, people in my position would always say, well, we can't control who's sent to us. And then I would stand up and say, but then we can do something with those that are sent to us. And so I sat on a racial disparity committee, a national committee for corrections, and still do. And we're looking at all different ways, whether it be parole. Give you an example of the 40-some percent you mentioned of those minorities that are in prison. Well, then internally what we should be looking at is, okay, so is 40% of those individuals in programming? Do 40% have jobs? Are 40% getting paroled? I mean, trying to equalize what happens, but more importantly, at the front end of the system, doing things that keep people out of that system. There's those that like to say we need to think outside the box. When I hear that, I gag. And the reason I gag is we don't need to think outside the box. The criminal justice system is doing exactly what it's set up to do. We need a new box. And that new box is taking a look at things like drug possession, addiction. We're sending addicts to prison because they're addicted. And there's something terribly wrong with that. It's morally and ethically wrong. And I think we need to rethink what we're doing in the criminal justice system.
Chief, I know you've got thoughts on this subject.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that we have an obligation at the front end to sort of look at where are those candidates that can be diverted, redirected, or put into programming that addresses the root cause of what's prompting the behavior. The police officer is trained to look at the instances of behavior that rise to those legal thresholds which are sufficient to stop, to arrest, and then we do a lateral, and the criminal justice system determines whether there's probable cause beyond proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict. And those are the legal standards that we're governed by, but I'd like us to not even have to reach those pinnacles of those thresholds at the outset. The sheriff mentioned addiction is the best case of case in point. Seriously, too, I bet you he would venture that when he was the sheriff here and similarly as the prison, how many people do we have who have arguably committed prohibited behavior, but that's owing to mental illness, and they've fallen between the cracks? Mental illness, addiction, sort of some of those property crimes that do not necessarily result in an immediate tangible victim, like a forgery or those sorts of simple thefts and sort of disorderly conduct things. Those are so many things that we can avoid jail with and ultimately down the road, prison.
I hear mental health debated a lot in the Capitol. Funding for homeless, things like that. Let me ask both of you this question. Is Wisconsin doing a better job at addressing mental health and the AODA, alcohol and other drug abuse addiction issues, or do we still have miles to go? Chief?
I will say we have miles to go before we sleep on that one. My officers are now working probably 22 to 25 hours daily in terms of our personnel dedicated to dealing with mental illness issues exclusively. Now, if you want to also look at the AODA issues, the opiate overdoses and the like. It's literally become staggering. It's so much a part of our workday now that we're losing staff for extended periods of time. For us, from the beginning point of contact, an evaluation, medical clearance, collaboration with mental health subject matter experts, and a determination to go all the way to Winnebago Treatment Facility in Oshkosh, these are 8 to 12 hour calls now, and it takes two officers. So we haven't begun to scratch the surface in terms of preemption and collaboration and more funding basis for programming for these issues.
What percentage of Wisconsin adult inmates mental health and IOTA largely, as opposed to Colorado? Was it similar?
It's similar nationwide, and I can tell you the Colorado statistics, and I'm sure Wisconsin's fairly close. Of those incarcerated, 77% are addicted to drugs, alcohol, or both. 30% have some type of mental illness. About 12% are seriously mentally ill, and I mean seriously mentally ill. And in Colorado, the average education level was about the seventh grade. I believe when I ran Wisconsin Corrections, it was the fifth grade. But the point is this. Everybody in my position stands up, and we say this many times, that we run the largest mental health system in our state, and Corrections does. The biggest myth out there is that states deinstitutionalized mental institutions. They didn't. What they did was they closed a number of hospitals for a lot of legitimate reasons, but then those patients started the walk from the hospitals to the prison system, and that's where they sit today. And having correctional officers and staff without the proper resources, same as law enforcement, to deal with those that mental health problems, and we're supposed to solve all this, as is the police. And, you know, I've thought all along that if I fall down out on the street and break my leg, an ambulance comes to help my leg. But if my mind's broken, there's no mental health EMS system that shows up, except for law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And that's something that needs to be changed. You know, we need a different response to this. Instead of calling law enforcement, there needs to be a mental health EMS type of system where they come, and then the appropriate place to take these individuals when they need assistance.
Chief, can you connect the achievement gap? Unfortunately, Wisconsin leads tragically in the mm-hmm. achievement gap between white and African American students with some of these criminal justice issues?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that Madison in particular has been a landscape of the haves and the have-nots over time. Yes, we have a very low unemployment rate as it pertains to white people. But it's literally, if you're hovering in and around the 3% level for most individuals, but then you look at underrepresented communities, minority communities like African Americans, that level is up to 28%. We are graduating fewer and fewer African American males at a level proportionate to and worse than Milwaukee at times. Our housing is among the most expensive, and yet our units available for rent are among the most scarce. So when you look at the economic limitations, the fact that we're not validating and affirming and getting kids to the point of at least a GED or graduation mm-hmm. level, that is creating a sort of a dysfunctionary economic underclass, if you will, where like-minded people are becoming more and more together, thrown together in these very desperate situations. And I do think that then lends to this perfect storm of opportunistic and desperate crime activity.
Thanks. I want to talk about, the governor recently called a special session on two gun bills, the universal background checks and the red flag proposal. I want to ask both you gentlemen whether you think either or both of those bills should pass and why. Rick?
I think they both should pass. When I was sheriff, which was quite a while ago, I would say that we need a permit system in the United States for gun ownership. But what I said was we need one permit, and so that a person is licensed to have a firearm, and if they want to buy 100 firearms with that one permit, they can do so. But they've had the background check, and they've got the permit. As far as red flag laws, that just is common sense to me. I mean, we've seen so many tragedies with those with mental health issues. Law enforcement's called. There's always warning signals, always. And if it's reported, it tends to be ignored. If it's on social media, it tends to not be taken serious. And then a terrible tragedy happens. And if that can be prevented, that's something we should do. And that's what the red flag laws are about. If someone's having some type of mental instability, until there's a consensus of what's happening and what can be done or not done, dangerous weapons should be taken away from
them. Does Colorado have a red flag?
No. It was same as Wisconsin. It was talked about. It was lobbied, and it failed.
Chief?
I think that the polls, no matter what partisan politics you follow, seem to suggest that there's a universality about acceptance of reasonable background checks for people who want to have a gun. And similarly, I agree with the sheriff in the sense that to those who suggest that the red flag laws represent some sort of specious affront to due process, I would beg to differ. We have an equivalency now that Rick is aware of course, is that we now have a process in domestic violence where one person, ex parte, if they feel threatened by their partner, can go and get a temporary restraining order, if you will, right, to create a legal mechanism of protectionism until such time as there's an injunctive hearing down the road where everybody's represented. Similarly, we're talking about an interim stopgap measure. The person is not going to be permanently deprived of their weapons. It's just a stopgap legal mechanism in which there will be a court process that will look at the sanctioning of whether that's valid or not down the road. And in the meantime, it provides law enforcement in the community with a preemptive tool to try to avoid a tragic circumstance.
So neither of you think a red flag law would be abused?
Again, I think if properly monitored by the judiciary, I don't think it will be, no.
Okay. How did you both react when former presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke out of Texas said, "You bet we're coming after your assault rifles"? Is that a helpful contribution? Is that a helpful thing to say, or is that just so impossible it's just off the charts?
Well, one, there's so many firearms out there now that it's off the charts to think you could do that. But my feeling is I'm a gun owner, and I'm an avid hunter. And so I respect firearms, and I also respect those that own them. And I know many people that have these, quote, assault rifles that use them for practice. They enjoy it. It's a hobby. They aren't dangerous. They're law-abiding citizens that legally own these firearms, and they are a danger to no one. The chief and I could talk about many ways that other firearms can be just as dangerous as, quote,
absolutely,
these assault rifles. There's ways to do that. I'm not going to discuss it publicly, but not to give anybody ideas, but there are things that can be done. So I think when you make a statement like that, to go beyond, you're probably saying, well, no one should have firearms. That's maybe the next step, or that's the inference, and that's just not going to happen here. There's just too many.
And I don't want to get into the partisanship of the political pulpits and
things
like that.
I don't either, but when a candidate running,
say, when you have something that's just over the top, that's just for headline grabbing and desperate acts of desperate politicians looking to get some traction. Because if we continue to overreach with statements like that, it's any wonder that we can't build or find a common ground of conversation about what's objectively reasonable. And I think that is manifestly unreasonable and not pragmatic, and that just strengthens the boundaries, if you will, between the groups on the Second Amendment and its interpretation. I don't think that was very helpful.
In 2011, Governor Walker signed our concealed weapon law. Signed our concealed weapon bill into law. I checked with the Department of Justice. As of November 3rd, 370,421 valid carry concealed weapon permits in the state of Wisconsin. I compared that to the number of adults. 1 in 12 Wisconsin adults has a CCW permit. That doesn't mean they're all packing.
Right.
But I'm curious, 8 years later, your thoughts on our CCW law, Chief?
Well, experientially, in terms of have these people become more inclined to get involved with police contacts of a negative context, I would say they're very rare, very infrequent. Most of the people who have gone through the pro forma process have a legitimate reason for doing so. They're responsible. They've been properly trained. And it's a mechanism of self-defense for themselves or for their family and their home and property. There's been probably a handful of instances I can recall where someone did something inappropriate who was a CCW permit holder, like, for example, engage in having alcohol at a bar, creates a disruption, and then we come to investigate the underlying disruption and come to find out that they're also shouldn't be carrying a weapon while they're at a bar and having alcohol, things like that. But for the most part, when you look at the sheer largesse of that number, yes, I'd say that the instances where we've had difficulties with people that are CCW holders are minuscule.
Are you surprised 8 years later that our CCW law has worked as well as it has without the a widespread number of incidents?
For me, I think I would have been. I think I would have been a little bit of the pregnant pause initially when it was first coming down the pike. And over time, I have found that my concerns or apprehensions have largely been resolved in the fact that I have not seen this sort of windfall of bad behavior from people who have had the permit and then go out and do some unscrupulous things with it.
Rick, your thoughts 8 years later?
Yeah, initially I was concerned. I was thinking of some situations, for instance, if someone's in an auto accident that has a concealed weapon and the paramedics come and who takes the gun and what happens to that and how do all these things work. And of course, thinking they would be used for wrongful purposes. But really, that hasn't occurred. And then the next question I ask myself is, do I feel safer as a result of the concealed weapon law?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No.
You know, but
no.
But it's here.
Do you agree, Chief? No?
I agree. I think that would be a legal fiction. And the one thing I will say with the CCW permit holders, we have a lot of guns getting ripped off in burglaries and out of their cars because there are so many more people holding permits. And so now these guns are falling into unscrupulous hands. And that's been an unintended byproduct. Especially to the CCW permit because so many people having access to weapon.
Did I interrupt you? Were you finished, sir?
No, I'm finished.
Okay. You gentlemen have more than 65 years of experience in law enforcement and criminal justice. How have public attitudes towards law officers changed over the decades that you've been watching it?
Well,
pregnant pause.
Yeah. I would say that it is definitely in a period of time right now where we are clearly having difficulties in terms of the credibility we have with the public. I think that we are trying desperately to show our want to be both transparent and accountable, reliable, trusted partners to our stakeholders, our constituents who pay our salaries and things. But over time, with social media platforms and a 24-hour news cycle through cable and satellite and whatever, on any given hour, I can probably see images of police officers behaving badly somewhere in the country.
Yes.
It's sort of the 99-1 rule where 99% are meeting and exceeding those expectations, but if you're only seeing the 1%ers who are not representing the integrity of the badge, the oath that they took and they pledged to uphold, then that's sort of the negativity that remains. And clearly, we have been complicit, we, the police community, with over time with contributing to the disparities that we have seen across the country. We're young enough to still remember our complicity in seeing segregation and Jim Crow laws being enforced at the hands of the law enforcement agency. So the other thing is I think there's a sort of desperation and an angst among our younger populations about wanting change and wanting it now. And the police officer in uniform is the most symbolic representation of institutionalism and the criminal justice system. So we are sort of in harm's way from the standpoint of feeling those frustrations. And I get it. I understand it. But it's definitely had effects on our ability to recruit, our ability to retain, and sort of the morale of the workforce.
Rick, the chief mentioned social media. And now almost every patrol stop, there's a camera somewhere recording it. Your thoughts on public attitudes changed, Rick?
Oh, there's no question. I think it's somewhat cyclical. I mean, I was in high school during the Vietnam riots here, And that fallout lasted after I became a sheriff's deputy. And so there was a public attitude then because of the perception they had of how law enforcement handled the riots in Madison. I can tell you an international story which I found very telling. I happened to, a few years ago, be in Poland working with about 20 Western European countries, and one of the individuals was a British diplomat, was there, and African-American. And we were conversing, and he told me that he had a sister that lived in Florida, and he had never visited her. And as he continued to talk, he said, "And I'm afraid to visit her." And I looked at him, and I said, "Are you worried about being shot by the police?" And he said, "Yes." And so that shook me. And that was an international observation of American policing. And as the chief said, there's bad officers doing bad things, which tend to override all the good officers doing great things. Mm-hmm. And so the perception is there that I think it's a very difficult time. You know, violence is going up in the prison somewhat, and that's a reflection of the community, because they're the worst of the community that tend to end up there. But and so what we're seeing in the community now is it seems to be a bit more okay to shoot a police officer. And we haven't seen that before. It's the disrespect of the position, and we're seeing more and more of that. I would not, unfortunately, recommend that anybody go into policing today.
Which is my next question. We've only got about a minute left, so short answers, please. If a bright young woman or man came to you and said, "I'm thinking about becoming a law officer," are you now counseling, "Don't do it," Rick?
You know, it's interesting. That's the profession my daughter wants to go in. And I tell her that I'm proud and I grit my teeth because I'm scared for her. And I don't tell her not to do that. But I can say that in general discussions like this, I would say I wouldn't go into the profession today.
Wow. I do. I've done, over the 5.5 years I've been chief, I've mandated exit interviews. I ask all the cops, good, bad, ugly, tell me, how can we improve? And then I asked that very question. I said, if you had a loved one who was going into the profession,
yes,
they all loved the experience, would not trade it, no buyer's remorse, but over 90% of those, I've done a spreadsheet, have said, no, they would not encourage a loved one to go into this profession, not under the toxicity of what they currently see playing out in the streets.
And it's not just that. It's not just that. It's understaffing.
Yeah.
It's lack of resources.
Absolutely.
That has a lot to do with it. You know, a lot of these incidents that are occurring that go wrong, a lot of them are because they don't have the resources to correctly handle the situation.
Thank you. If I'd said that, I'd be in trouble. No, it's true. And I also say that they feel a lack of support from their public officials, that it's easy for pollsters to look at what the current litmus test is and back that side, as opposed to understanding the difficulties and challenges that law enforcement faces.
Let me add another international experience. I happened to visit the Swedish prison system, and they've visited ours. Now, Sweden has a population of about 10.3 million people. The director there, he and I have become professional friends, he oversees everything. So what we would consider the county jails, the state prisons, the federal prisons, he has it all. He had, at the time he visited, less than 5,000 incarcerated. Now, Colorado has
a population of 10 million. Excuse me.
10 million. Colorado has a population of about 5.3 million. And in our system alone, in the state prison system, I had 20 to 22,000 inmates. Mm-hmm. I tell people that I met a lot of Swedes over there, and they were very nice, but they didn't seem nicer than Coloradoans. And the point is that we are so over-incarcerated in this nation that how do you address that population when you can't possibly have the resources to do that, because they just keep sending them to us? And it's a door that just keeps revolving because we can't fix it because we don't have the resources. And that includes policing also.
Wow. Very constructive conversation. I didn't get to ask several questions, including about ICE, but maybe we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Retired Police Chief Mike Koval, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Former Sheriff.
Thank you.
And Wisconsin and Colorado Prison System Administrator Rick Ramish, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civics broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol. Wisconsin Eye would not exist without generous donors like you. Please visit wiseye.org to make a donation today.